Dulles brothers would go on to do the very same thing the next year, 1954, in Guatemala?
That's right. They were on a roll. They thought they could do anything, exert their will anywhere in the world. Jacobo Arbenz, again, a popular Democratic leader elected in Guatemala.
We only have 10 seconds in this portion.
The Kennedy of Guatemala is overthrown again by the Dulles brothers. Partly because they were representatives of United Fruit. United Fruit was a major, you know, power player in Guatemala.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to do part two, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. David Talbot is author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot is founder and former and editor-in-chief at Salon. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Port Orford Sustainable Seafood, Oregon's community-supported fishery, delivering monthly shares of line-caught seafood direct from the small fishing town of Port Orford to seafood-loving communities throughout Portland and the Willamette Valley. Details at posustainableseafood.com and at 541-671-0704.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We have been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Workgroup, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planRFP2015.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a whole bunch of lawsuits. Environmental groups have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service for allegedly allowing Nestle to bottle water from California's San Bernardino National Forest.
The two psychologists credited with creating the brutal post-9/11 CIA torture regime are being sued by three victims of their program.
And a federal appeals court has ruled that a suit against the city of New York over a surveillance program targeting Muslims should proceed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 13th, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has obtained a temporary restraining order against Appleby Aviation to stop the company from illegally engaging in commercial pesticide activities. The department sought the order after it discovered that Appleby was illegally spraying pesticides while its commercial pesticide operator's license was suspended. The company has a long history of illegal spraying. This recent action stems from an incident in April of this year in Douglas County. A truck driver for the company, Daryl Ivey, was repeatedly exposed to chemical spray from an Appleby helicopter over a three-week period. Ivey became a whistleblower, using cell phone videos he had recorded to support his claims of unsafe practices. Appleby was finally given an immediate license suspension and a fine of $1,100 on September 25th. The following day, Appleby Aviation was spraying pesticides in Clatsop County, and again on October 1st and 2nd in Lake County. The Agriculture Department's investigation of Appleby Aviation is continuing, and they expect to take additional regulatory action against the company.
Last week, the U.S. Forest Service, USFS, proposed one of the largest timber sales of the past 25 years in the Wallowa-Whitman National Forest. The USFS, along with other federal and state agencies, released an environmental study for about 50,000 acres of public land between Anthony Lakes Recreation Area and La Grande. The stated primary purpose of the East Face Vegetation Project area is to reduce the risk of large wildfires. The project calls for commercial lodging on 6,700 acres. The environmental assessment is available for a 30-day public comment period.
Environmental groups have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service for allegedly allowing Nestle to bottle water from California's San Bernardino National Forest using a permit that expired 27 years ago. The suit, brought by the Story of Stuff Project, the Courage Campaign Institute, and the Center for Biological Diversity, challenges Nestle's four-mile pipeline that siphons water from the Strawberry Creek in the San Bernardino National Forest to bottling operations in Ontario, California. The water line supplies Nestle's Arrowhead brand of bottled water and over the last year drew about 68,000 gallons of water per day out of the forest. The groups asked the court to immediately shut down the pipeline and order the Forest Service to conduct a full permitting process that includes environmental reviews. A spokesperson for Nestle said that the company was doing its part by reusing water in its factories for cleaning and for cooling of equipment. The director of the Story of Stuff project, Michael O'Haney, said, "Until the impact of Nestle's operation is properly reviewed, the Forest Service must turn off the spigot."
And now, something a little different from H2O Radio, This Week in Water.
Coral reefs are dying all over the planet, and sharks respond to what? Those and other stories for the week ending October 11th, 2015. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, scientists said that we are now witnessing a massive worldwide environmental event. Coral bleaching.
Bleaching occurs when warm ocean waters stress organisms and kill off algae that provide corals with their color and nutrients. Without them, they turn white and can die.
After corals die, reefs quickly degrade. There is then less shoreline protection from storms and fewer habitats for fish and other marine life, including ecologically and economically important species.
The coral problem has been observed in Hawaii and is now seen in the Caribbean. It began in the North Pacific in the summer of 2014 and expanded to the South Pacific and Indian Oceans in 2015. This event is likely to continue into the next year.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration noted last week that coral bleaching and disease is brought on by climate change coupled with events like the current El Niño.
One NOAA official said that to solve the long-term coral problem, we need to understand how to reduce the unnatural carbon dioxide levels that are the major driver of the warming.
The flooding that occurred last week in South Carolina had a devastating impact. At least 17 people lost their lives, and damages will likely surpass $1 billion.
In some areas of the state, more than 20 inches of rain fell in a short time. Many people are facing severe losses because their homes weren't covered by flood insurance, mainly because they weren't in an area that was considered a flood zone.
But the larger question is whether this storm and others are occurring due to climate change. One scientist, Michael Mann of Penn State, told CNBC that the rainfall can be attributed to record high sea levels, which add moisture to the air.
He noted that climate change is increasing the probability of these storms and that they're really no longer 1,000-year events.
A study late last month concluded that powerful storms that might have occurred along the New Jersey and New York coast every 500 years or so are now likely to occur every 25 years.
According to one insurance company, the South Carolina flooding is the 6,000-year rain event in the U.S. since 2010.
Fracking has been linked to premature births and high-risk pregnancies.
A study done by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health shows that the controversial method of extracting oil and gas is associated with a 40% higher premature birth rate for mothers who live in areas of intense drilling and fracking operations.
And their pregnancies were 30% more likely to be high-risk than those of mothers not living in drilling areas.
The study focused on fracking in Pennsylvania, where in 2006, there were only about 100 unconventional wells, but now there are more than 8,000.
The leader of the study, Brian Schwartz, said in a statement that the growth of the fracking industry has gotten way ahead of our ability to assess both the environmental and public health impacts.
He added that policymakers need to consider these findings in allowing this industry to go forward.
The oceans of the world are in rough shape, from plastic pollution and overfishing to acidification from carbon emissions. But this week, there's much good news to report.
We just got a bit closer to the UN's goal of protecting 10% of the oceans by 2020. At last week's Our Ocean Conference in Chile, several countries declared plans to protect the world's marine ecosystems.
Starting with the host country, Chile, which announced plans to create two massive marine conservation parks in its Pacific waters.
The first will be around what are called the Desventuradas, or Unfortunate Islands. A two-day trip from the Chilean coast, the islands contain pristine deep underwater mountains with species new to science.
The second reserve will be around Rapa Nui, or Easter Island as we know it. Famous for its stone statues, Rapa Nui waters are a spawning ground for tuna, shark, marlin, and swordfish. Commercial fishing will be banned from the area, but the indigenous peoples, who were involved in designing the sanctuary, will be able to continue their traditional fishing practices.
Combined, the two conservation areas would protect more than 350,000 square miles, larger than the country's total land mass.
The United States used the conference to reveal plans for two proposed marine sanctuaries, one in the tidal waters of the Potomac River that provides important habitat for rare and endangered species, and the other as a national underwater shipwreck preserve off of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin.
These commitments come on the heels of New Zealand's plans to create a vast ocean sanctuary off its northeast coast.
But the conference wasn't only about marine sanctuaries. It also took on the problem of agricultural pesticides and fertilizer runoff contributing to ocean dead zones.
Possibly the most significant initiative from the conference will be plans to regulate the world fish trade. According to the World Wildlife Fund, global marine populations are half what they used to be in 1970. And finally this week, since we're talking about oceans, are you a fan of Shark Week and happen to have heavy metal in your playlist? If so, then this story's for you.
A Discovery Channel crew, filming recently for the enormously popular show Bride of Jaws, was on the hunt for a humongous 16-foot great white nicknamed Joan of Shark.
In an effort to be more eco-friendly, instead of tossing chum into the water, they blasted death metal through an underwater speaker.
They didn't lure in Joan the Shark. Maybe she'd prefer a different song, but they did manage to attract two other great whites.
It seems that sharks are able to hear nearby prey, so to speak, by tuning into subtle vibrations in the water.
Apparently, the dense throbbing sounds of metal rock are a near perfect match to the low frequencies emitted by struggling fish.
Using rock music to attract the animals isn't new. It was first discovered by a tour guide operator in Australia.
Mark Waller told Australian Geographic magazine that sharks don't have ears, they don't have long hair, and they don't headbang past the cage playing air guitar, but they do love themselves some AC/DC.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more, coloradowaterwise.org.
California Governor Jerry Brown signed and vetoed hundreds of bills last week. The regular legislative session ended last month, and Brown had until October 11th to either veto or sign the bills on his desk. An automatic voter registration law, similar to Oregon's, was among the bills that Brown signed. Critics, including Fox News, are attacking Brown for that measure, claiming that non-citizens will be allowed to vote as a result. That won't happen because the California Department of Motor Vehicles keeps track of the citizenship status of all who receive licenses. Another bill signed into law extends Medicaid coverage to children and young people under age 18 who do not have legal status. Other measures approved by Governor Brown include a bill preventing any public school from using a particular ethnic slur as a team name. That slur is currently the name of the professional football franchise based in Washington, D.C. Brown vetoed a similar bill that would have banned naming schools, parks, or public buildings after Confederate soldiers and political leaders.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Yesterday was a federal holiday named after a world-famous explorer who got lost and thought he was somewhere very, very far away from where he actually was. For years, my personal name for yesterday's holiday has been Lost Italian Day, but recently, community after community is finally starting to wake up to this horrific story of genocide of indigenous people and no longer celebrating that mythical tale. Just this past week, in fact, the Portland City Council changed the official name of this holiday to Indigenous Peoples Day. Hooray for Portland. And yet it's only one tiny little symbolic gesture compared with what is actually necessary and, in fact, urgent if we're to continue to survive long-term as inhabitants of our one and only Mother Earth. What every government at the local, state, and federal level must really do, and soon, is to start acknowledging and respecting Native American treaty rights across the landscape, not just when it's convenient, not just when the corporate leaders are in support of it, but all the time, everywhere. The doctrine of discovery is the centerpiece of the genocide story of what we have come to think of as the United States of America. It's amazing to me that I had never even heard the term doctrine of discovery till many years after I finished college. It's a term that every American really needs to know and understand its significance. Quoting primarily from the website doctrineofdiscovery.org, we learn that the papal bulls of the 15th century gave Christian explorers the right to claim lands they, quote, discovered, unquote, and lay claim to those lands for their Christian monarchs. Any land that was inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited. If the, quote, pagan, unquote, inhabitants could be converted, they might be spared. If not, they could be enslaved or killed. The discovery doctrine is a concept of public international law expounded by the U.S. Supreme Court in a series of decisions, initially in Johnson v. McIntosh in 1823. The doctrine was Chief Justice John Marshall's explanation of the way in which colonial powers laid claim to newly discovered lands during the so-called Age of Discovery. Under it, title to newly discovered lands lay with the government whose subjects discovered new territory. The doctrine has been primarily used to support the discovering government's exclusive right to extinguish the right of occupancy of the indigenous occupants. This doctrine governs U.S. Indian law today and has been cited as recently as 2005 in the decision City of Sherrill v. Oneida Indian Nation of New York. Talk about institutionalized racism still being alive and well today in the 21st century. Wow. The U.S. Supreme Court has always been front and center as an institution designed to support the consolidation of wealth and power in the hands of the few, and more recently in the hands of the business corporation. Except a business corporation doesn't actually have hands, or a head, or a heart, or a brain, even though most of us generally use personifying language, when what we're really talking about is a mere it that doesn't even exist in the material world. An it with constitutional rights. It's absolutely bizarre if you really think about it, and yet the corporation for almost two centuries now has been the placeholder for where power and constitutional rights reside under law because the Supreme Court says so. We take it for granted today that the Supreme Court is unassailable, that we have to put up with its decisions because there is no legal appeal process, that its judges are appointed for life by the president, and yet all of these supposedly untouchable rules were made up by people who have been dead for a very, very long time. So why do we, the people, play dead in our response to the ongoing outrage, which is the Supreme Court's ongoing violation of our self-governing authority? One big reason is that we don't know our own history, so we don't know what has been attempted in the past or what social norms there used to be, such as the concept that corporations were once held legally subordinate to the people via their state legislatures, that corporate directors and shareholders were once held fully liable for all harms and debts, that corporate interference in our elections was once a felony, and much, much more. The outrage that is the U.S. Supreme Court, that we have all come to know, started with their 1803 decision Marbury v. Madison. This case established the concept of judicial review, which meant that the court could declare an existing law unconstitutional, and that law would then be voided. In other words, the Supreme Court ruled that it was supreme, no longer one of three equal pillars of government. The justices gave themselves the power to make law, which was never the intent of the nation's founders, and Congress did not contest it. Then President Thomas Jefferson was so outraged by this seizure of governing authority by the highest court in the land that he stated, quote, "The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please," unquote. Once the Supreme Court could overrule the other branches of government, any real notion of authentic representative democracy began to fray, not to mention that in the early 1800s, only white-propertied men had the status of legal persons, so most of us couldn't even participate if we had wanted to. Over the next handful of weeks, I will be unveiling the fascinating story and chronology of how the Supreme Court, over the past 195 years, has transformed the business corporation from an institution that was legally subordinate to the people, beginning after the American Revolution, into something having more constitutionally protected so-called rights than do you or I. It's a pretty sordid story. So hang on to your britches as we continue this story next week. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my twice-monthly updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @CNFuegosPaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for The Union Edge. This will be followed by Preference at 6. Alan Silver hosts and talks with Jeremy Brownlow, the typewriter troubadour. Jeremy is one of the performers in Gender Identity Showcase. During the second half of the hour, you're invited to call in and share your coming out stories. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, mostly clear with a low around 51. Tomorrow, patchy fog before 11 a.m., then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 76. Today in history, in the year 54, Nero succeeds his great uncle Claudius as the new emperor of Rome. In 1792, President George Washington lays the cornerstone for the White House. And in 1981, Egypt's Vice President Hosni Mubarak was elected president 1 week after Anwar Sadat's assassination. The quote of the day is from Desmond Tutu. "I have witnessed the systemic humiliation of Palestinian men, women, and children by members of the Israeli security forces. Their humiliation is familiar to all black South Africans who were corralled and harassed and insulted and assaulted by the security forces of the apartheid government."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
For today's report, I have a whole bunch of statistics for you. Wait, don't run away. Where are you going? Come back here and sit still while I drill these stats into your head. I realize that numbers can numb the brain, but this is a good story, and I promise that these statistics are easy to absorb. In fact, the number 400 pretty much sums it up. It's a story of political intrigue and corruption involving some of America's wealthiest families and corporations. Start with the Billionaire 400, a clique of the elite organized by the conniving Koch brothers. These ultra-rich right-wingers gather each winter in some warm-weather resort for a secretive, invitation-only retreat. There, they plot strategies and pledge money for electing politicos who will support their vision of corporate rule in America. For the 2016 elections, they've already committed nearly $1 billion to impose their vision of plutocracy over our democratic ideals, double the combined amount that the Republican and Democratic parties will spend. Then, there are the secretive super PACs that are sacking up tens of millions of dollars to back various presidential candidates. Again, a mere 400 corporations and rich families, each writing checks for hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars, have put up nearly half of all the money in these electioneering committees. But now, here comes the antidote to this corruption of our politics by fat cats. Instead of being financed by 400 special interests, Bernie Sanders' campaign has raised its $15 million from 400,000 ordinary Americans. In fact, the average donation to Bernie is a heartwarming, soul-saving $31.30. This is Jim Hightower saying, you can't buy a president for 30 bucks, but you can help elect one who is not owned by big money. And isn't that the way it ought to be?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The two psychologists credited with creating the brutal post-9/11 CIA torture regime are being sued by three victims of their program. The charges include human experimentation and war crimes. The suit was filed today by the ACLU against CIA former military psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen on behalf of torture survivors Suleiman Abdullah Salim, Mohammed Ahmed Bensoud, as well as the family of Gul Rahman, who died of hypothermia in his cell as a result of the torture he endured. The suit, which is the first to rely on the findings of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture, charges Mitchell and Jessen under the Alien Tort Statute for, quote, their commission of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, non-consensual human experimentation, and war crimes, end quote, all of which violate international law. The defendants earned more than $80 million for designing, implementing, and personally administering the program, which employed a pseudoscientific theory of countering resistance that justified the use of torture. That theory was based on studies in which researchers taught dogs helplessness by subjecting them to uncontrollable pain.
A federal appeals court today ruled that a suit against the city of New York over a surveillance program targeting Muslim individuals, businesses, and institutions should proceed. The New York Police Department began its wide-ranging surveillance, which extended to New Jersey and other surrounding states, following the attacks on September 11, 2001. A lawsuit was filed against the city in June 2012, alleging discrimination against Muslims in violation of the First and 14th Amendments. A federal district court granted the city's motion to dismiss in February of 2014. That court ruled that the plaintiffs had no legal standing to file suit and had not shown any injuries from the program. A three-year judge panel of the federal appeals court disagreed and remanded the case back to district court to be reconsidered. The judges concluded that what occurs here in one guise is not new. We have been down similar roads before. Jewish Americans during the Red Scare, African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement, and Japanese Americans during World War II are examples that readily spring to mind. We are left to wonder why we cannot see with foresight what we see so clearly with hindsight, that loyalty is a matter of the heart and mind, not race, creed, or color.
And now for a two-minute lesson in labor history, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. That was the day that newspaper carriers for the San Jose Mercury News ended their walkout. 80% of the newspaper carriers were Vietnamese immigrants to the United States. Many were elderly or recent immigrants with families. The paper carriers often had to get up in the wee hours of the morning to complete their routes. They earned about $6 an hour. The carriers would also have money taken from their paychecks for the people on their routes who were delinquent in paying for their papers. San Jose is part of the tech industry growth of California's Silicon Valley. The economic disparity between the rich and the poor and working class in the area is stark. The newspaper deliverers were classified as independent contractors, meaning they legally had no protections and could not join a union. They knew that they had to work together if they wanted to improve their wages, their hours, and conditions. One carrier explained that the workers' concerns were, quote, thrown in the garbage by our supervisors. The carriers appointed John Hao Do as their spokesperson. They demanded a 20% raise. When management would not listen to their demands, carriers on nearly 50% of the routes stopped delivering the newspapers. The walkout lasted 6 days. At the peak of the action, nearly 50,000 newspapers had gone undelivered. 557 carriers participated in the walkout. Finally, management agreed to a 12% raise. They also agreed to end the practice of garnishing wages for delinquent subscription fees. The paper also reinstated 4 workers who had been fired due to the walkout. The newspaper carriers had shown the power of collective action. Extra, extra, read all about it. Workers stand together and win better wages, hours, and conditions. Now that's a headline worth reporting. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The International Association of Machinists is using technology and a National Labor Relations Board ruling to allow Boeing workers in South Carolina to sign union cards digitally at home. IAM spokesman Frank Larkin.
Digital technology is advanced to the point where it's so common, it's legal in both banking and legal documents, and there's no reason it shouldn't be legal and valid for the purpose of organizing. If there is any type of harassment or oversight when employees are considering whether or not to sign a union card, it gives them the security and the privacy to do it without worrying about that.
The IAM contends that Boeing moved work to the South Carolina plant to avoid union activity in Washington State. Larkin says Boeing management acknowledged that in part their move was in retaliation for union activity in the Northwest. A union election at the South Carolina plant was scheduled for April, but the IAM withdrew from it, citing a corporate misinformation campaign and outside political interference. But Larkin says the organizing effort continues in South Carolina.
It's not unusual for a union organizing campaign to go through several election cycles before they achieve collective bargaining. The Boeing campaign in South Carolina obviously has a lot of components to it, including the opposition to it. So it's a learning process all the way around. But ultimately, many of the workers there expect they will have a union contract.
James Otto is a California attorney representing Disney workers he says were fired so they could be replaced by low-paid foreign workers. He says Disney fired over 700 competent U.S. workers in Florida, Anaheim, and Burbank, California, and in New York. Disney required them to train their foreign imported replacements. Otto says there are companies specializing in using worker visas to import low-paid foreign workers to displace American workers. He says that is illegal discrimination.
I am using the civil rights law of both the federal government and the state of California. To discriminate against anybody based on certain categories is illegal. It's a crime. What these importers, these body shops are doing, and what the U.S. employer is doing is intentionally excluding, is discriminating against U.S. workers. They're excluding them from the job market.
Otto says in 2014 alone, 9.9 million foreign workers were brought into the U.S. to take American jobs, often at lower wages.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Across Turkey, families and friends said goodbye to loved ones as they buried their dead following a twin suicide attack over the weekend. On Saturday, two blasts ripped through a crowd at a peace rally held by Kurdish and leftist activists in the capital, Ankara. At least 97 people died. Many more were wounded. In the predominantly Kurdish southeast, Saturday's tragedy is compounded by continued clashes between security forces and guerrillas in towns and cities across the region as the country slides back into open confrontation between the military and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Diyarbakir.
Footage captured Saturday by Turkish journalist Fatih Pinar in Ankara shows scores of people dead, maimed, and walking wounded, crying out in vain for ambulances and medics to attend to the injured. As the country comes to grips with the deadliest attack on civilians in its modern history, many are questioning how it could have happened and why. Why did it take security forces and emergency services more than 20 minutes to arrive at the scene outside Ankara's central train station? No one has yet claimed responsibility. Turkey's government condemned the attacks and broadly suggested who it suspects might be responsible. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu suggested Monday that either the PKK or a deeply infiltrated radical group could be behind the carnage. But in an interview with Turkish broadcaster NTV, he said the so-called Islamic State, known here by its Arabic acronym Daesh, is most likely to blame. Buradaki
saldırıda da. These three terrorist organizations are seen as potential suspects for this attack. But when we looked at how the attack happened and the general tendency of the events, Daesh has become the primary suspect.
Many people here blame the government for, at the very least, failing to protect its own people. In Diyarbakir, hundreds of mourners turned out to bury a local politician and an elderly woman activist, both of whom were killed in the attack. The city's mayor, Gulten Kesenek, says so far there are more questions than answers. She notes that the bombs exploded near some of the most guarded areas of the city.
The Prime Minister's office building is there. All of the important institutions are in that very center, and there are intelligence officers who are protecting them. There are cameras everywhere. So for such blasts in such a central area, it's impossible that the state had no knowledge that this was going to happen.
The weekend attack came the same day that the PKK offered a unilateral ceasefire to allow for parliamentary elections, scheduled in less than 3 weeks. But the government dismissed the offer, calling it a political tactic, and doubled down on its assault on PKK guerrillas in the mountains. Turkish F-16s continue to fly sorties against PKK positions, and warplanes buzz low over Diyarbakir. At the funeral, Vessel Oak, a local media attorney, says people here don't want to return to war. They've already had plenty of that in more than 30 years of an insurgency that's claimed more than 40,000 lives and counting.
People is so angry, I think, from the government, from the state.
It seems like people are being kind of pushed together, pushed to fight, right?
Yes.
Now. How far do you think people will be pushed here before they'll push back?
I think people don't want war. Don't want war. Yesterday there is a walking in Diyarbakir. Around 10,000 people is walking, and they say one thing, only peace.
The PKK issued a statement on an affiliated website Monday, saying out of respect for the dead, it will continue its unilateral ceasefire, but added the group would defend itself if attacked. Turkish military officials say operations are ongoing and claim Sunday airstrikes killed 17 PKK fighters. Two Turkish soldiers reportedly died in weekend clashes elsewhere in the country. Meanwhile, the historic center of Diyarbakir remains sealed by security forces aiming to clear PKK fighters from the heart of the city. An opposition politician told FSRN Monday that security forces killed at least a half dozen people in the city since Saturday. And for the residents of Diyarbakir, a return to some semblance of normal life seems to be an increasingly distant prospect. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Diyarbakir, Turkey.
The International Criminal Court, or ICC, is investigating both Russian and Georgian forces for possible war crimes. The investigation centers around the five-day conflict in 2008. The ICC says they have evidence suggesting South Ossetian forces killed up to 113 ethnic Georgian civilians, and both sides killed peacekeepers. That is a war crime. Also, Russian forces may have participated in the killing of civilians.
Tension continues to spiral in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. After a week of growing unrest in the West Bank, the violence spread to Gaza, where the Israeli military met weekend rocket fire with an airstrike, killing a pregnant mother and her two-year-old daughter. Monday, another four stabbing attack attempts were reported in East Jerusalem. Lena Odgaard reports for FSRN.
Monday morning, a Palestinian man attempted to stab a group of Israeli police officers. CCTV footage shows the officers approaching the man, who suddenly jumps at one of them with a knife. He is quickly surrounded by several officers who shoot and kill him. Later, in two other separate incidents, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded after allegedly stabbing a police officer and two Israeli teenagers. The attacks are the latest in a series of stabbing incidents, primarily carried out by Palestinians against Israelis throughout the past week. The uptick in violence started after a young Palestinian girl was shot dead by Israeli soldiers in Hebron in September, allegedly wielding a knife. A week later, an Israeli couple was shot and killed as they were heading to their home in a settlement in the West Bank. Speaking to his cabinet Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he will not tolerate internal incitement.
We will use all means at our disposal against instigators from any direction.
Several human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, accuse Israel of excessive use of force and warn that this is only leading to further escalation of the violence. But in general, according to Shawan Jabarin, director of the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, the use of excessive force is not something new. He points out that this year alone, Israeli soldiers and settler extremists have killed more than 25 Palestinians, all before October's escalation.
And the Israeli, they feel by force they can solve everything. And force cannot solve everything and cannot maintain peace. The only thing can maintain peace and stability is justice.
Jabarin has analyzed videos documenting the shootings of several of the alleged attackers and sees little evidence of a threat to the lives of the Israeli soldiers or policemen before they opened fire.
This is, I think, it gives us an impression that these days, the military and the police, they shoot to kill. It's like an extrajudicial killing. It's not just using excessive use of force. It's more than that. Intentionally, they shoot to kill.
He's worried about this new apparent trend of young Palestinians carrying out random stabbing attacks.
But the new issue is when you see a 16 years old just carrying his knife and go to stab, and he knows well that he will get shot and killed. This is, I think, it's a danger issue. We have to wake us up to think that those people, they lost their hope.
Throughout the West Bank, Palestinian protests calling for an end to the Israeli occupation continue, while similar protests in Gaza over the weekend were heavily subdued by Israeli forces. Nine Palestinians were killed, including two minors aged 13 and 15, when protesters confronted Israeli soldiers in border areas, throwing stones and attempting to break through barbed wire fences. In response to rocket fire from Gaza, Israel launched several airstrikes, killing a pregnant woman and her two-year-old daughter when warplanes targeted their home early Sunday. The number of Palestinians killed since the start of the month has now reached at least 25, among them 8 children and youth. Additionally, the Palestinian health organizations report at least 3,000 people have been injured, more than 1,000 by live and rubber-coated bullets. In the same time frame, 4 Israelis have been killed and dozens injured. Lena Odgor for FSRN in Ramallah in the West Bank.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla, Doug McVeigh, and Jim Thompson. The engineer is Sokoina Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland speaks with Wilbur Slokish, Jr., longtime native fishing rights activist and traditional Klickitat chief, about coal and oil trains. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Lisa Loving speaks with Duncan Berry of Fish People Seafood about certified B corporations and the movement of people using business as a force for good. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert talk about planting garlic and cover crops and, after the rains come, transplanting just about anything. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for the Union Edge.